I said. I couldn't imagine dealing with all the family shit. That's all right, son, he said. You don't have to come. The next time, you be on Ed Sullivan. It'll be a duo. What do you mean? He said, it'll be you telling jokes and me kicking your ass. That made me laugh, but I knew he meant it. A few hours later, my Aunt Dee called to check on whether or not I had any sense at all. I said, yes, tell Dad I'm coming home, but only because I don't want him kicking my ass on Ed Sullivan. My dad was very broken up when I got there. Everybody else talked about the weather. We was going to my stepmother's funeral. It was one of the coldest days in the history of Peoria, Illinois. Like 20 below zero. I'm sitting in the back seat with my father crying and shit, and I say, Pop, it's all right. Hey, man, it's gonna be okay. He said, man, it get any colder, I'm gonna have to bury the bitch myself. That's my father. I'm not lying. He'd be at the graveyard talking to the preacher. Say, man, when's the shit over? God damn. Get to the part about the date. Shit, I love you, baby, but shit, god damn, it's cold out here. Paul Mooney started taking me to Red Fox's club located in central Los Angeles. It was the right place for me at the right time. With a black audience, I was free to experiment with material that was more natural. It was frightening, since I didn't know myself and had to learn who I was. It was like I was there, but I wasn't there, you know? Yet, it was also lovely, comfortable. I talked about the black man's struggle to make it in a white world, which was also my struggle. For the first time since I began to perform at Harold's Club, I saw black people laughing. And not just at cute shit. They laughed at the people I knew, the people they knew. Was enlightening. None more so than Red Fox himself. Red was a player, a hard player from the old school. He carried a switchblade, sometimes a gun. He ran the club like a gangster, treating friends like relatives and enemies with scorn. People were beat up regularly. Red also liked the cocaine, too. I spent many nights when I felt as if we were in the Coke Olympics. But Red was a mesmerizing storyteller. The best ones always concerned his friend Malcolm X. Not only did listening to that shit fascinate me, it sparked a fire inside my brain. It was an awakening. Malcolm was a bad motherfucker, Red said. But he also took care of business. He was proud, brilliant, sincere, passionate, dedicated to teaching about human beings, about being human. In the early days, Malcolm hated what he called the white devil, Red explained. Then he realized that we were all different shades of the same stick. The motherfucker got killed for it. It was the same evolution that I'd go through. Strangely, I hadn't been affected by Malcolm X's death when it occurred. However, after Red introduced me to him as a person and what he stood for, I missed him terribly. A few months later, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated outside his Memphis motel room. I was in Chicago that day. I watched the news on the TV in my hotel room and tried to understand the loss. I couldn't. Neither could I make any sense of Robert Kennedy's murder 2 months later in Los Angeles. At the time, I was walking down a hotel corridor in Washington, D.C. It must have been right after the shooting. Ed Sullivan passed me, rushing the opposite direction. Something seemed wrong. He didn't stop or say hi. He seemed in a daze. Moments later, after I turned on the TV, I was overtaken by that same glassy confusion. The good ones were being bumped off. John, Malcolm, Martin, and Bobby. What to make of it? I wanted to understand why that shit had happened. But there was no way. It was part of a whole collage of shit that I couldn't get a grip on. I probably wasn't alone in that respect, though I sure felt like it. In early 1968, I worked at the Village Gate in New York, one of the few clubs that didn't object to the new material I was performing, which the more conservative bookers considered inflammatory, crude, and in some cases, obscene. And to think I was just starting to find myself. Going there gave me the opportunity to meet actress Shelley Winters, who came backstage and asked if I'd be in her next movie, Wild in the Streets. I don't know, I said, but I'll try. The money aspect interested me, but far more important at the time was meeting jazz great Miles Davis, who was the club's headliner. Though our paths hadn't crossed, Miles and I were brothers waiting to meet. Kindred spirits. Before we even spoke, he did something that no one else would have done, because no one would have understood the shit I was going through without a detailed explanation. But Miles's radar picked me up like a lost plane. About half an hour before the show, he had one of his guys come to my dressing room and tell me the lineup had been changed. Miles is going to play first, he said. What? I asked, wondering what the fuck was going on. Miles is going to open, then you follow. The gesture was pure Miles, intuitive, supportive, generous, and in sync with the moment. By trading places, he was giving me a vote of support. Beyond that, he was leading me to the edge of the diving board. He knew that I was frightened, and he knew I thought the jump was hard, but he also knew that I could do it if given a nudge. I just had to believe in myself. Be brave, he was telling me. Be true to your own self. Listen to the music inside your head, Rich. Play with your heart. After the show, Miles invited me to his dressing room. When I entered, he was kissing Dizzy Gillespie with tongue and shit, which made me wonder what kind of shit he had planned for me. But Miles played a different tune with me. We got in a cab and went to a midtown apartment, where he introduced me to a woman I called the Gypsy Lady. She was dark and mysterious, with eyes as hot as fire. She had the best cocaine I ever tried. It was a big motherfucking rock. Like the Hope Diamond. We chopped and snorted until the sun crept through the windows, and then we disappeared like vampires. From now on, you get your coke from her, Miles said as we left. She's got the best. After that evening, our lives became intertwined, by Miles and mine. I played his music, collected his art, admired his independence, understood his rudeness, and loved the way he talked. That was probably the best thing about Miles. That voice, it fascinated me like nothing else. No matter what he said, Miles sounded cool. Those shows marked the beginnings of my transformation into Richard Pryor again. Though change was not without its price, I didn't act as if I was married. I hung out till all hours at nightclubs. I indulged my appetite for drugs and booze and jive. I let temptation serve as my muse. I wasn't close to being normal. I couldn't stop drinking till the bartender said, "He got no more fucking liquor." I had no conscience. One night, Mooney brought April, a beautiful sports writer, to Shelley's and my little cabin in the hills. And as with any attractive female, I wanted her, chased her. I got down on my hands and knees and begged, and then I went off with her. Shit, did Shelley ever want to strangle me? I couldn't stop myself even after Shelley became pregnant in the fall of 1968. But then I didn't see myself as clearly as others did. I remember Red Fox. And I spent an entire night and most of the next morning at a little table in his club, battling each other for the attention of a sexy waitress, listening to jazz, and snorting cocaine by the spoonful. I kept asking for more, 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 and Red kept giving it to me until finally I was too tired to inhale. "Hey, Red, why do I always want more?" I asked. He laughed as if to emphasize my ignorance. "Because you're a junkie." Then it was my turn to laugh. "Bullshit. I just didn't see it." Later, when I finally went home, Shelley was waiting for me, and she wasn't happy. "You don't love anybody, do you?" she asked. "I love Miles," I said. That wasn't exactly true. At the end of September, while I was working on the movie Wild in the Streets, my father died. I was still in bed when the phone rang. Shelley and I ignored it. But the ringing continued as if that phone was screaming, "Get the fuck up and answer me, motherfucker!" Shelley got it. "Richard, it's your grandmother," she said. "Hello, Marie." He'd been with 5 women. 5 at the same time. In the midst of it, his heart gave out. Shit. "I want to die like my father. He died fucking. He was 57. The woman was 18. He came and went at the same time. Didn't nobody cry at his funeral. Everybody just said, 'Lucky motherfucker.' And nobody else would fuck the woman for 2 years. I don't want none of that pussy. No, thank you." I hugged Shelley for a long time. Needed her strength as tears ran from my eyes. "King is dead," I finally muttered. "Long live the king." Shelley traveled with me to Peoria, where I was immediately overwhelmed by the pull of family. "You can never escape, can you?" I asked myself. "Not even when you die." My dad lived in a nice house that he'd bought several years earlier with $20,000 in cash that I'd handed him one night following a Chicago club date. A lot of shit went down inside me when I walked through that door, and he wasn't there. My whole family was gathered there. The place was packed. Still, I felt an unmistakable absence. "Daddy, your father fucked everything," my Aunt Maxine said. "Just be glad he didn't fuck you." "Okay." Tender thought. My grandmother, who had already taken over his house, chose me to go to the funeral parlor and pick out the casket. I didn't want to do it. I was his child, his baby. Inside, I cried, "Why, Mama? I don't want to." But who else was there? I was the only son. I was the only one with monies. Well, I picked out something that seemed like him. Nothing fancy, nothing crazy, just a casket. And when I got back home, they gave me the worst shit. "Why'd you get that? What kind of casket is that? Did you try to save money? Didn't they have anything fancy? This is your father, after all. Shit!" I didn't know what to say. It was as if they were beating me up because they didn't know what else to do. Thank God for Shelley. She came to my defense. "Damn it, you all shouldn't have done that to him," she yelled. "He went down there. He went through the pain. He did his best. None of you offered to help." There was silence. Stunned motherfucking silence. Because no one dared talk back to Marie. But Shelley did. And everybody knew she was right. Because of her outburst, that day became very important to me. It didn't mean I loved anybody less. But in a way it freed me some. Loosened those chains. Shelley flew home before the funeral. Since my father wasn't Catholic, the service was held in St. Patrick's Gymnasium on October 4th, 1968. He was buried in St. Joseph's Cemetery later that day. I didn't think it would hit me as hard as it did. White people love their dearly departed, but their funerals be different. They don't give it up easy. They hold that shit in until they get home. Then they cry softly. Oh, but black people let it hang out. And they fall on your ass. They don't ever faint. They just lean on your ass. You have to carry them to the car. Say, bitch, get up. Damn, you got to get on me because that motherfucker's dead. My grandmother yelled like that. Scared the shit out of you at a funeral. I said, what's the matter, mama? I thought maybe my dad had raised up or something. No. He was dead. The odd thing was, now that he lay dead, I couldn't stop talking to him. You know, inside my head. Conversation flowed, man. But when he was alive, I don't think we ever really talked. No, hey, Dad, can I ask you shit? No passing on stories or advice. Most of the time he'd come into the room, say some stuff, and I'd go, yes, sir. Even as a man. One time I got tired of my dad kicking my ass. I had a fight with him in the front yard. Well, it wasn't exactly a fight. I did the best I could. I said, man, I'm tired of taking these ass whippings. I ain't taking no fucking more. And that's it. What, are you a man now, motherfucker? Yeah, okay. And he hit me in the chest so hard that my chest just caved in and wrapped around his fist and held it there. I looked at my dad one last time, wearing his best suit. I put a little money in his pocket. Hey, Dad, just in case there's any action up there. 16. Watching television, which supposedly puts your brain to sleep, has always had the opposite effect on me. Paul Mooney and I used to yell at the shows as if the actors could hear us. The shit was so stupid that it was funny. I knew I could write much better. I always wonder why they never have a black hero on any of the shows. I always wanted to go to the movies and see a black hero. I figured maybe someday they'll have it on television, man. Some funky music plays, and then, look! Up in the sky! It's a crow! It's a bat! No! It's Super Nigger! As with so many ideas hatched in living rooms beneath clouds of dope smoke, mine sounded crazy but brilliant. Instead of a television show, I was going to make a movie. I'd write, direct, produce, and star. Since Hollywood wasn't overflowing with opportunities for black actors, Paul and I would create our own opportunity. It sounded so simple that it seemed possible. We'll get our friends together and do it, I said. Where are we getting the money? He asked. Me? I said. I'll put it up. I'll produce. Who's going to direct? Me? Who's going to be in it? Everybody we know. Oh, shit. We began shooting Bon Appetit in March 1969. Penelope Spheris, a successful director now, was the camera operator because she had gone to film school. But that's as much legitimacy as the film had. The picture opened with a black maid having her pussy eaten at the breakfast table by the wealthy white man who owned the house where she worked. Then a gang of Black Panther types burst into the house and took him prisoner. As he was led away, the maid fixed her dress and called, Bon Appetit, baby! The rest of the movie, which was retitled The Trial, was a silly stab at a political statement. The Panthers held the guy in a basement and put him on trial for all the racial crimes in U.S. history. Black Caesar, Superfly, and Cleopatra Jones hadn't come out. I thought we were breaking new ground. But halfway through the editing process, we ran out of money. To keep the dream alive, I borrowed money from a shady character I knew. Eventually, I brought in a few more people like him. Then there was a falling out. The unfinished print was stolen. I brought it back, and then it disappeared again. It was a better story than the film itself. One day, Paul saw the film advertised as a coming attraction at a downtown art house. After some investigation, I managed to reacquire the print, which still wasn't completed. In a last-ditch effort, I persuaded Bill Cosby to put up money for a final edit. Then he and I watched the final print. He said only one thing. "Hey, this shit is weird." I agreed. The movie was strange, too strange, even for me. Despite the effort, I shelved the print and learned a lesson. To make a movie from start to finish, you need a good reason. I just ran out of them. There was one successful production that summer. On July 16, 1969, the day the Apollo 11 astronauts lifted off, Shelley gave birth to our daughter, Rain. She was the first of my three children to arrive when I was in a state where I could welcome her. I just wasn't sure about the rest of the world. After Rain was born, a nurse told me she had to fill out a birth record and asked what she was. "A human being," I said. The nurse, irritated, asked the question again, this time adding, "Is she black or white?" "I already told you," I responded. "She's a human being. Just write that on your goddamn form." I didn't know anyone more aware of their image than Billy D. Williams, who I met on the TV pilot, Carter's Army. Suave and handsome, he was also very serious about his career and what people thought of him. Mooney and I played poker at his house, but he didn't like hanging out with us anywhere else. He worried that we were going to get him in trouble. I didn't remotely identify with that worrywart shit. My life was populated by characters. There was Prophet, a moody but talented painter, Dirty Dick, a whole circus of hustlers, whores, winos, and hangers-on. I thought they were people who knew stuff worth knowing. But then I've never claimed to be a great judge of character, you know. I did slightly better with pets. Shelley and I, renting Red Fox's house at the time, filled it with a menagerie of creatures, including a couple of Afghan hounds, some lovebirds, and fish. Mooney gave me a squirrel monkey, who I named Boyfriend. We got along okay. I even thought he kinda liked me more than was normal for a monkey. I called it Friend, because the first time I opened the cage, he ran up my arm and stuck his dick in my ear. It felt like a wet Q-tip. When there wasn't no action for him, he got mad and pissed all over my cheek. I grabbed the motherfucker and threw him up to the ceiling. He grabbed the chandelier and laughed. "Thought you had me, didn't you?" I felt sorry for Boyfriend. As I watched him swing through his cage, he seemed lonely. So I bought him a friend, a female squirrel monkey who I called Girlfriend. I got him a beautiful little woman. I called her Sister. And he did the same thing to her. He ran right in the cage and stuck his dick in her ear. She said, "Freeze. First thing I gotta do is show you where the pussy's at." Then he got some monkey pussy and went crazy. Mooney, who begrudgingly watched the animals whenever Shelley and I went out of town, resigned his caretaker post once I added Girlfriend to the mix. In need of a new babysitter for several weeks, I pressed Dirty Dick into service. He was my only option. Still, I should have known better. When I got back, both of the monkeys were dead. "They killed themselves," he said. "Committed suicide." "What?" I asked, shocked. "Yeah," he said, pointing to a gas burner on the old stove in the middle of his kitchen. "They accidentally turned it on and suffocated." I thought he killed them on purpose. Distraught, I went home and cried. Shelley didn't understand why I was taking it so hard and asked me to cry outside. As I sat grieving, The mean German shepherd from next door hopped the fence. Normally, he terrorized the monkeys, but he seemed forlorn, too, and put his head in my lap. I felt something push in my hand. I looked down, and he said, "Hey, Rich, what's the matter?" "My monkeys is dead. They died." He said, "What? Your monkeys is dead? You mean the ones that used to be in the trees? Damn, I was going to eat them, too." Then he said, "Life's a bitch, ain't it? One day you're here, the next day you're gone. Well, don't linger on it. You know that shit can get to you. Thank you." He went away, walked to the fence, and got ready to jump over. He turned around and said, "You know, I'm going to be chasing you tomorrow." The monkeys weren't the only casualty. Shelley and I weren't going to make it much longer. The sparks were gone. We fought constantly. Mooney referred to our place as the House of Pain. Instead of giving each other pet rocks, now we threw them at each other. My wife and I had a lot of fun for a long time. She had this girlfriend with big titties. You know the type I'm talking about. You tried to ignore them for 6 months. Then she'd come into the house and you say, "Hello there. How are you doing?" "No, I don't really notice your tits." One day my wife came home and said she left her wallet over at her house. I ran, "I'll get it!" And I got the guilties. I had to tell her. 'Cause I thought she knew when she asked, "Have you seen Ethel?" "I did it!"
"Did what?"
"Fucked Ethel." "You fucked Ethel?" She went and kicked Ethel's ass. As Shelley's and my fighting became fiercer and more frequent, I took increasing refuge at Dirty Dick's. In good times, I had spent much of my time buying cocaine and shooting the shit with the lowlifes, whores, and addicts who were always at Dirty Dick's. Now I spent even more in his den of debauchery. Shelley knew what went on up there. She hated Dick, and she hated how much time I spent hiding out with him. Periodically, she threatened to follow me to his house, go there with me, participate in the games, but I kept it off limits. The place was too nasty for her. It was also mine. "I don't want you up there," I once said. "It's no place for you." "Well, then come home," she said. "Spend more time with your family." "What did you think, Rich?"
"Yeah, right.
That's why I was up there, you know. I didn't want to spend time with my family. Didn't want to spend time with myself. Didn't want to spend time. Wanted to buy me some time." "I will," I said. "Just give me one more night. I need one more night."
"Good, Rich.
Why'd she believe you?"
"You think she did?"
"No, because one more night turned into dozens more. Couldn't help myself. Like Red Fox said, I was a junkie. No matter what I promised, once was never enough." Shelley was smart. She knew that. One night, she went up to Dirty Dick's to find me and drag my doped-out ass back home, where I had promised to leave it. Only I wasn't at Dirty Dick's that night. I was getting high someplace else, hanging with some other characters of ill repute, I'm sure. But the fact that Shelley had crossed into Dirty Dick's shadowy world made me crazy with anger and paranoia and jealousy. Knowing the sordid shit she would be exposed to at Dirty Dick's, I should have been concerned about Shelley. Worried, protective, ready to apologize and admit my wrongdoing. Instead, I thought, why is she doing this to me? What right does the bitch have telling me what to do? What the hell was she doing anyway? I got pissed, you know? You be in love and you don't want nobody in your puss, especially when you find one that fits. I don't want no motherfucker stretching your pussy out. The trouble was this. I didn't want to admit the truth. Jelly and I were history. We just hadn't reached the finish line yet. We still had to limp down the final stretch, shouting at each other and fighting as if that would help. Heartache is like an education for a man. We don't really grow up until a woman breaks your fucking heart. That's your diploma. If you come through that, Jack, you're a man. My first comedy album, recorded live at the Troubadour, didn't quite measure up to my favorites. I had loved Bob Newhart's first recording so much that I'd pilfered it from a little store in Peoria. Bill Cosby's debut album was perfect, perfectly hilarious, and in my mind, nobody to this day has made an album as brilliantly funny as Lenny Bruce's Lima, Ohio. Mine was a good, though uneven, effort. Routines like Super Nigger revealed the voice that was trying to break through. A point of view was percolating beneath the surface. I just didn't know enough to put all the pieces together. For the cover, I took off my clothes and parodied the cover of National Geographic, though when I think back on the day I was photographed, I don't remember going native as much as I do the way Shelley went after me. During the shoot, Sonny Stinson, my old friend from Harold's Club, showed up. Shelley saw us hugging and went ballistic. Worse, she beat the shit out of me. What the fuck is wrong? I yelled. But I knew. I was affectionate to everyone but her. She was right. I deserved the beating. I just didn't want to take it, you know? And that was it. The end. We find Super Nigger with his X-ray vision that enables him to see through everything except Whitey, disguised as Clark Washington, a mild-mannered custodian for the Daily Planet. He's shuffling into Perry White's office. Hey, man. I'm quitting, baby. Great Caesar's ghost. I can't talk to you now. Talk to me, Jack, because I'm ready to quit, man. You dig? I'm tired of doing them hauls. Every time I finish, Lois Lane and them come slipping and sliding down through there, and I got to do them over again. You dig it, baby? I'm through. With an arrest warrant issued against me for failure to pay child support to Maxine, and with Shelley wanting to kill me, I had more than enough motivation to get the hell out of Dodge. My life was a mess. It was as if I was stuck to a funnel cloud that was tearing a path of destruction everywhere I went. I sensed catastrophe around the corner and knew I had to get out. One day, Mooney and I got in my car and aimed the motherfucker north. I wanted to go to Berkeley. I don't know why there, except I had it in my head. For 8 hours, we drove up Interstate 5, drinking cheap wine and singing Motown songs at the top of our voices. When we ran out of songs, we made up new ones. Obnoxious, loud, drunk, and exhausted, we rolled into the red-hot center of the counterculture as if late for a party. I didn't have a single notion of what I was going to do, but being there felt right. I can't talk to you now, Perry White says to janitor Clark Washington. The warehouse is on fire. What warehouse? Warehouse 86. Damn, that's where I got my stash. This looks like a job for Super Nigger. 17. I settled into a life that was drastically different from the comfortable but miserable one I'd fled. I rented a small one-bedroom house for $110 a month. I bought a bed, threw it on the floor, and stuck a TV by it. Don't tell Martha Stewart, but that was it. I was done with the furnishings. I thought it was nice, though. Ghetto chic. Such austerity was necessary. If I was going to find my lost soul, I needed to cast off everything but the bare essentials. I had to renounce the past in order to discover the future. House, car, clothes, women, friends. I tossed them all away. No one knew where I was, and no one got in unless I wanted them to. It was the freest time of my life. Berkeley was a circus of exciting, extreme, colorful, militant ideas. Drugs, hippies, Black Panthers, anti-war protests, experimentation, music, theater, poetry. I was like a lightning rod. I absorbed bits of everything while forging my own uncharted path. I indulged every thought that popped into my sick head. I read and reread a copy of Malcolm X's collected speeches. I put Marvin Gaye's song, What's Going On my stereo, and played it so often it became the soundtrack for my life up there. What's going on, Marvin would sing. Fuck if I know, I'd answer. In a city of spectacles, I became one myself. I shambled in and out of coffee houses in an old kimono, sandals, and a tall cone-shaped hat that made me look like a deranged wizard. My sense of humor was equally bizarre. Some nights at clubs such as Basin Street West, Mandrakes, and The Showcase, I just made strange animal noises. Other nights I repeated a single word like bitch or motherfucker, but gave it 57 different inflections. Each outing was like playing jazz, searching for that one perfect note that would carry me into a higher state of bliss. I never thought about what I was going to do until I did it. Sometimes I stunk. Sometimes I surprised myself. But I went with whatever happened, you know. As a result, I became braver, more confident, and willing to tap into whatever provocative or controversial thoughts I had. During one such performance, I repeated the most offensive, humiliating, disgraceful, distasteful, ugly, and nasty word ever used in the context of Black people. The word embodied the hatred of racism, as well as a legacy of self-hate. Nigger. And so this one night, I decided to make it my own. Nigger. I decided to take the sting out of it. Nigger. As if saying it over and over again would numb me and everybody else to its wretchedness. Nigga. Said it over and over like a preacher singing hallelujah. Hello, I'm Richard Pryor. I'm a nigga. Nigga, nigga, nigga. Nigga, 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 nigga. Maybe you didn't notice, you know, because they didn't tell me till I was 8 years old. Saying it changed me, yes, it did. It gave me strength, let me rise above shit. Faster than a bowl of chitlins, able to leap slums in a single bound. Honest, it made me feel free to say it. Clean. It was the truth. That's all I was looking to say. The truth. I'm glad I'm Black. I'd hate to be white. 'Cause y'all got to go to the moon. Ain't no niggas going to the moon, you know that. First of all, there ain't no niggas qualified. Or so you all tell us. If niggas was hip, they'd help y'all get to the moon. Hey, let's organize and help them white motherfuckers get to the moon, so they leave us alone. Among my discoveries in Berkeley was an extremely passionate, highly charged, super sophisticated renaissance of Black intellectual, artistic, and political activity. It was fueled by the minds and fervors of stars like activist Angela Davis and novelist Ishmael Reed, who were smart, proud, committed, and uncompromisingly Black. The bunch I knew could also party their ass off. Cecil Brown, who wrote the novel The Life and Loves of Mr. Jive-Ass Nigger, told some of the earthiest, most entertaining stories ever around 3 a.m. Through Cecil, I met Claude Brown, the author of Man-Child in the Promised Land, and Reed, who impressed me as one of the most honest people I've met. By comparison, I was uneducated and ignorant, though listening to their ideas inspired me just as Malcolm X's writings had. I wanted to do something. One night, I served as the disc jockey on a radio station, playing Miles and rambling on about Nixon, The Vietnam War, the Black Panthers and shit. I didn't know anything about that shit. But who better to talk about it? Then I got the idea I could write. For a time, I holed up in my house and wrote. Fueled by coke, coffee, cigarettes, and alcohol, I cranked out page after page of stories containing ideas and opinions that I thought were important. I'm a serious motherfucker, I told myself. Finally, I got the guts to show my work to Reed. He sent it back with the note, "Man, this ain't my language." Well, that stopped my attempt at serious writing cold. He could have said, "Motherfucker, you can't write." But he made it hard. He was cold and, as I said, honest. I heard that Shelley was hanging out with Miles. I don't think they were lovers. Just that they were spending time together messed me up. Women get their heart broke, they cry. Men don't do that. Men hold it in like it don't hurt. They walk around and get hit by trucks. Didn't he see that truck? Man, he wouldn't have seen a 747. His heart was broke. I was so pissed off about Shelley and Miles that I walked into a pawn shop, bought a trumpet, and blew it on a street corner outside an Italian restaurant. Only I didn't know how to play the trumpet. Not a fucking note. But I blew the motherfucker as if the shrill, discordant sounds that went screaming into the darkness would let everyone know how unhappy I felt inside. Then Bill Cosby, of all people, walked out of the restaurant to see who was playing such shit. He had to have figured it was someone real avant-garde or a terrorist. He looked stunned to see me. "Man, what are you doing?" he asked. "Playing the trumpet?" "No, you aren't," he said. "You're making everybody in the restaurant sick." Bill invited me to join him inside, where he was eating with two of the tallest, prettiest white women I'd ever seen. I thought, damn, wouldn't you know? But after a while, one of those Amazon beauties gently stroked my leg underneath the table. I looked across the table at Bill and said to myself, "Sick my ass. Man, that trumpet shit worked." Berkeley was full of characters worse than me, and I seemed to get tangled up with all of them. I hung out with a coke dealer named Haywood, who lived by the water in Sausalito. He once gave me a samurai sword.
"Here, man, cut off your head," he said encouragingly. "Do the honorable thing."
I also remember Gina, this hippie chick whose entire self-worth centered around a pair of satin shoes Janis Joplin had given her. One night, in a fit of downright cruelty, I threw those shoes into the bay. Sweet Jesus was a pimp who controlled everything. And I still shudder at the thought of Crazy Mary, a whore who had wooden teeth. I made a grave error with her once. I gave her money. In her eyes, that made her something. She followed me around town. She showed up at clubs while I was on stage. She raised tons of hell. "Where is he?" she screamed in a voice that ripped through even the noisiest nightclubs. "Where the hell is my Richard?" One time she barged into the bathroom while I was inside doing my business. I kicked the door shut. She pushed it open again with her shoulder. I smashed it shut again and told her to get the fuck away. "Open this goddamn door right now," she yelled.
"No."
"Why not? You're just shitting. Everybody shits." Crazy Mary scared me. She wanted to fuck me up as much as she wanted to fuck me. Finally, I went to Sweet Jesus and told him about my situation. He promised to help, and from then on, Crazy Mary with the wooden teeth didn't bother me anymore. She didn't bother anyone. The really scary people like Huey Newton didn't bother me. Huey and I met at a party in Oakland, and then did cocaine in my hotel room. As we got high, the Black Panther's Minister of Defense got angry because his woman was coming on to me, and I didn't tell her to stop.
The scene got very tense. It seemed certain something was going to happen. Either Huey was going to lose control and hurt me, or I was going to provoke him into hurting me by saying something stupid. Both seemed likely. We were talking about jail. He admitted to being worried about going to prison himself. "Why are you scared of jail?" I asked. "'Cause if I go, everyone's going to want to fuck me," he said. I didn't disagree. "But if they put their dick in my mouth," he added, "I'm gonna bite it off." "That's a plan," I said. "But right before you bite, you know, you're going to taste that dick in your mouth and wonder whether or not you like it." Huey Newton shot up from his seat and punched me. The blow caught me on the side of the head. "Fuck you." It could have been messy. Both of us were high, we had guns, and we were out of our minds. Fortunately, I decided my best move was to watch as Huey grabbed his woman and marched out of my room. I knew that I could stir up more shit on stage than in a revolution. I could be a revolutionary, but I like white women. I have a white women disease. One night, when I was snorting cocaine in Haywood's house in Sausalito, I met Casey de la Vega, a stewardess who I referred to as the Contessa for both her beauty and the sound of her last name. She fell in love with my sense of helplessness, treating me as if I was a doll or something. She cooked for me, dressed me, and even tried giving me her Porsche. A few months later, she followed me back to L.A. There was no single reason I left Berkeley and returned home. By the end of 1970, I just felt full. I knew it was time to go back and resume my career as Richard Pryor comedian. For the first time in my life, I had a sense of Richard Pryor the person. I understood myself. I knew what I stood for. I knew what I thought. I knew what I had to do. I had to go back and tell the truth. The truth, people can't always handle it. But I knew that if you tell the truth, it's going to be funny. Part 2. Mudbone Part 2.
Fascinating. That's what he is. Of course, the boy knew nothing about the shit he was talking about. But knowing shit ain't no prerequisite for achieving great things. A lot of stupid people think they're smart. And a lot of smart people know they're stupid. Everybody else, they just works hard, try to get by, drink every now and then, and take a little pussy. Old Rich was like that in some respects. He blew back into town too stupid to know better and too smart to care. The government was about to get all over his ass for not paying taxes. Woman sued his ass for child support. And then his ex-wife was about to get a divorce from him. If he'd taken the time to think about things, he might not have come back to California. Told me once, "My wife went to court, man, and she looked so young and pretty. Like a little girl." And I said, "Who is that bitch?" She told the judge this and that. And when I looked up, he was crying. The judge was crying. I looked at my lawyer and asked, "What do I do now?" And he said, "You're on your own, Rich." Then the judge said, "Nigga, we want everything. Do you have any dreams? 'Cause we want them too." After the boy finished telling me that, I took a taste of wine and remarked that dreams is the blood of the soul. That he obviously possessed way too much soul for any judge to take away. That's what drugs do to you. Beats the soul. Of course, he didn't listen to me about that either. Was too busy getting that cocaine in his nose. Reminded me of a dog licking his balls. Called him every day for a week and asked, "Boy, what you doing?" "More," he said. "Well, you want to go do something else?" And each time he said, "Why?" No one there to tell the motherfucker otherwise. It was different when I first went to Hollywood. See, after the big one, World War II, I tried to get into the motion picture business, too. Read about it in the paper, said, we want stars. Shit, in that respect, I was just like Rich. I knowed I was a star. Natural born, because I couldn't do nothing else. Also, I figured Hollywood was going to be like it had been in France. Wall-to-wall pussy. So I come out and went for this audition. Motherfucker said it was for King Kong. Gave me the script. I didn't know what the story was. King Kong, I said. I don't mind being a king. Sure, that's a pretty good part. Change the motherfucker's last name, you know, to Williams or somebody. A little too Chinese for me, that Kong shit. The director said, I don't believe you understand. What I'm trying to say is that this is a movie about a gorilla. I replied, well, you got the wrong nigga, motherfucker. I ain't no motherfucking gorilla. And I don't appreciate you calling me to this audition. I took the script and threw the motherfucker down. Them motherfuckers had me out of there so fast, motherfucking dirt didn't even get on the rug. Snatched me right out like that. And I got on the freight train and went all the way back home. Considering that experience, maybe I should have warned the boy. I knew what was going to happen to him. Could have told him nobody in Hollywood give niggas no good parts. All they'll smile at you, take you out to lunch, let you get some money in your pocket, but they still be looking at you like you a gorilla. Take what they did to the boy. They pretended to be there for him, scratching his back, hollering, we got you, Rich. No worries, brother. Except when he fell, you know what? They missed his skinny black ass. They caught the monies. No problems there. They missed his ass. Fortunately, the boy is like one of them old-time niggas. In them days, niggas was too hungry to die. Nowadays, you shoot a nigga, he falls over. Sad to say, most of the niggas nowadays be shooting themselves. Doing the dirty work themselves. Shit. Ain't got no pride. Back in the old days, nigga lived just to spite the motherfucker who wanted him dead. Didn't want to give up the wine or the pussy. That's what Rich was like. Didn't want to give up none of that. In fact, he wanted more. More, more, more. Did you ever get it? I asked. That's the thing about being an addict, he said. You never know, good or bad. You never know. 18. Back in L.A., I started working out again at Red Fox's club. One night, Red gave me a fedora to wear. It was more than a friendly gesture. I saw it as the passing of a torch. The master had given me his blessing. I took it seriously. My first concert film, Smokin', filmed at the Improv in New York in April 1971, contained new bits like Black Cat with Neat Hair, Colored Guys Have Big Ones, and Dracula and the Brother. My second album, Craps After Hours, also explored race, sex, and drugs, but with even more shape and sting. I knew routines dealing with getting high, fucking my wife's girlfriend, and rednecks looking for pussy were different from anyone else's. I didn't want merely to shock people. I wanted to be good. I wanted my stand-up to be like a night at the theater. Mooney was the one who told me what people thought about me. I was hot in the black community long before I cracked the mainstream. The word spread. Clubs were packed whenever I played. My shows were events, sojourns into territory considered dangerous, taboo, and, as all of us know, true to life.
That's part of what made it so damn exciting. Me and the audience were breaking new ground. People don't talk about nothing real. Like you talk about shit that's real. Like jacking off. A lot of people say they don't jack off. I did. I used to jack off so much I knew pussy couldn't be as good as my aunt. I didn't see why that shit I talked about was considered controversial. It didn't make sense. You can't talk about fucking in America. People say you're dirty, but if you talk about killing somebody, that's cool. My personal life had no brilliances either. I lived with Casey in a house overlooking the Sunset Strip. It was not a scene that could be described as loving or tranquil. We had a birthday party at a fancy restaurant once, invited a lot of people, got dressed up. But Casey and I arrived fighting and continued yelling through dinner. Finally, the waiter served the cake. I blew out the candles and then smashed the cake in Casey's face. As I got up to leave, the waiter offered her a towel. In a deliberate, ladylike fashion, she cleaned herself up and then to the waiter said, "I'll have my coffee now." That was tame compared to the other shenanigans that went on when the Contessa wasn't around. Sometimes I spent days at a time hanging out, snorting cocaine, and bullshitting with Mooney, the only one who never got high, Dirty Dick, and Prophet, an artist friend who resembled Miles Davis. When the air cleared, we ventured down the hill to the Candy Store or the Daisy, exclusive private clubs in Beverly Hills. I wasn't a star, but they still let us rub elbows with a crowd that included Elizabeth Taylor, Peter Lawford, and Sal Mineo. Once I saw drunk Richard Harris chase Bobby Darin out of the Daisy. At the Candy Store, I followed Kim Novak around like a dog hoping for a sniff. Another time, Mooney and I arrived just as Steve McQueen was leaving. He shoved his face straight into mine and asked, "Is that Dick Pryor? Is that him?" I looked him right back and said, "No." As I walked by, I heard him say to Mooney, "The guy looks just like him." "And you look just like Steve McQueen," Mooney said. If that was a put-on, I was once the victim of an even better act than mine. I spotted her standing beside the dance floor at the Candy Store. She told me her name was Matrasha. She was as beautiful and exotic as her name. A dead ringer for Josephine Baker. After a night of drinking, flirting, kissing, and dancing, I took Matrasha home. But we did blow and got down to business. The next time we were together, Matrasha forgot to do the tuck and fold. When I reached down, I discovered that she was actually a he. For some reason, I didn't care. Either I wanted the nut too badly, I was too high to object, or I was as sexually confused as Matrasha. It was probably a combination of all three reasons. Matrasha and I carried on for several weeks. We even went out dancing at the Daisy. I never kept him a secret. Mooney, for instance, knew I was fucking a dude, and a drop-dead gorgeous one at that. I even admitted doing something different was exciting. But after 2 weeks of being gay, enough was enough, and I went back to life as a horny heterosexual. I was the only dude in the neighborhood who'd fucked this faggot. A lot of dudes won't play that shit in the daytime, but at night, they'd be knocking on the door. Then I saw him like 10 years later. He'd be, "Hi, Rich." A while later, Mooney delivered a message from Matrasha. He'd realized a lifelong dream and undergone a sex change operation. Now biologically a woman, she wanted to get back together. I passed. By then, I had more than enough to handle. Given the word on the street, I wasn't surprised Motown founder Berry Gordy and director Sidney Furie assumed a lot of shit about me when I auditioned for Lady Sings the Blues. From the questions they